Our Old Testament reading for today is from the book of Exodus, starting the 32nd chapter, the first 14 verses. Moses has gone up in the mountain to speak with God and will eventually come down with the Ten Commandments. This is what's going on in the meantime. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make gods for us, who shall go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us up out of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Aaron said to them, "Take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took them and formed in a mold and cast the gold in the image of a calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation, "Tomorrow shall be a festival to the Lord." They rose early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought sacrifices of well-being. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to revel. The Lord said to Moses, "Go down at once. Your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have acted perversely. They've been quick to turn aside from the way I commanded them. They have cast for themselves the image of a calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it, and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" The Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and of you I shall make a great nation." But Moses implored the Lord and said, "O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with an evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce wrath, change your mind, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember Abraham and Isaac and Israel, your servants, how you swore to them by your own self, saying to them, 'I will multiply your descendants like the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.' And the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he planned to bring on his people." Our New Testament reading is from the Gospel of Matthew, the 22nd chapter, the first 14 verses. "Once more Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding banquet, but they would not come. Again, he sent other slaves, saying, Tell those who have been invited, Look, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fatted calves have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast.' But they made light of it and went away, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his slaves and mistreated them and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his troops, destroyed those murderers, and burned their city. Then he said to his slaves, 'The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Go therefore into the main streets and invite everyone you find to the wedding banquet.' Those slaves went out into the streets and gathered all whom they found, both good and bad, so that the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man there was not wearing a wedding robe. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding robe?' And he was speechless. Then the king said to the attendants, 'Bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen.'" If you got an invitation to a state dinner at the White House, would you go? And if you went, would you try to dress appropriately and behave well? Or what if you had received an invitation to the recent wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton? Where would that rank on your social calendar? In the parable that Jesus tells us in today's reading, the king gave a great wedding banquet for his son and invited many people. It was a great honor to be invited to the king's feast. This was obviously not a spur-of-the-moment affair. These people had to know what was in the works and what day it was going to happen. They had plenty of notice. And when the time finally arrived, the king sent servants to call the guests to the feast. This was standard practice in a time when there was no such thing as synchronized clocks and when all cooking was done over fire, whether it was an open fire or in a brick oven. Pinpoint accuracy was just not possible. Everyone knew approximately when and then waited for the announcement that everything was ready. The servants went out, the announcements were made, and nobody came. The king must have been wondering what was going on. Maybe the invited guests just didn't get the message. So the king sent more servants with explicit instructions. Tell the guests, the oxen and fatted calf have been slaughtered, everything is ready, come to the wedding banquet. Some guests made excuses and went about their ordinary business. Other guests were annoyed and mistreated or even killed the king's servants. Things in this parable are getting rather strange. You do not just turn down the king's invitation without an important reason. If you must refuse the invitation, you send your regrets with your reason. If you're smart, you probably also send a nice gift. Offending kings is not a wise thing to do. So it's strange enough that some of the invited guests ignore the summons to the wedding feast, especially for what seem like trivial reasons. Can you imagine anyone turning down an invitation to the wedding of Prince William and Kate? These people certainly had the opportunity to make arrangements to cover their farm and business needs for this particular time. Even stranger is the mistreatment of the king's slaves that results in the death of some of them. Are these guests trying to start a war with the king? It sounds like insanity. Indeed, the king is enraged. He sent troops to destroy the murderers and burn their city. The king decided that the people on his fancy guest list were not worthy of the honor of being invited. However, the king still had a huge amount of food prepared and a wedding to celebrate. So he sent out another group of slaves into the streets to get everyone they encountered to come to the wedding banquet. The slaves gathered up everyone they could find, both good and bad, and filled the hall with guests. When the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man who was not appropriately dressed. He asked the man why he had no wedding robe, but the man could not answer. So the king had the man bound and thrown out into the darkness. What are we supposed to make out of this parable? Why did Jesus tell it? Does it have anything to say to us today? Jesus gives us a clue when he begins the parable with the phrase, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to." He begins other parables with "the kingdom of heaven is like." What is the kingdom of heaven? Why is it so important to Jesus? And what does it have to do with us as followers of Jesus? As Americans, we don't spend much time thinking about kingdoms. We don't have a king, and we don't think of our country as a kingdom. We're vaguely aware that England and European countries have kings and queens, and they call their countries kingdoms. But that doesn't seem to have much to do with us. But if the kingdom we're supposed to think about is the kingdom of heaven, then it definitely does have something to do with us. Heaven is another way of saying God's place. Maybe Jesus calls it the kingdom of heaven because he wants us to think about those aspects of kingdoms that also apply to God and God's relationship to us. In a kingdom, there is one person who is in charge, who has the authority to make decisions, the one who gives orders and everybody else obeys. The one who has the authority to make decisions also has the responsibility for the care and protection of all in the kingdom. Earthly kings may not do a good job of exercising their power wisely, but the idea is based on God as the perfect king. Jesus is counting on his hearers to know about kings and kingdoms, to recognize the similarities between God and the king in the parable. He's also using the parable to point out the ways that his hearers are like the guests invited to the wedding. If God is like the king in the parable, some of the ways are pretty obvious. As creator of the universe, God is in charge. God has all the authority there is, since God is the author of all that is. It sounds like slam dunk. Everything will go just the way God wants it to, right? The parable suggests that the universe is not going the way that God intends it to. People, both great and small, are ignoring what God wants and doing what they want. This does not mean that we should never do anything we desire or that we think will make us happy. It does mean that we need to pay attention to what God wants. Many times we know what God wants, and we decide we're too busy right now. We'll take care of it later. We're not being disobedient, you understand. We just need to work it into our calendars when we have more time. If your calendar is like mine, it doesn't have huge amounts of empty time. There's always something that needs doing. In fact, I'm quite good at ignoring some of the things that need doing, like vacuuming, in favor of things I find more enjoyable, like working in my garden. We do this all the time. And we tend to treat what we know God wants us to do like I treat vacuuming. Sometimes it's inconvenient. Sometimes it pushes us to do something that we find uncomfortable, like visiting a sick friend who's not likely to get better. If we put it off enough times, maybe we won't have to do it at all. Remember the guests who made light of the king's invitation to the banquet? They begin to sound a lot like us, don't they? I have to go to my farm. I have to go to my business. Won't run itself, you know. My personal affairs are much too important to be interrupted by a summons from the king, the creator of the universe. It sounds pretty silly when we put it that way, doesn't it? God cares enough about me to put me on the guest list for the banquet, the social event of the decade, the century, forever. And I can't find time to go. We won't talk about the networking opportunities to meet the other movers and shakers in the kingdom. We'll ignore the chance to draw closer to the king and the most trusted advisors in the kingdom. We will not think about making ourselves part of the king's entourage and what might become of it for ourselves and our families in the future. We'll only concentrate on right now, this minute, and what we think we need to do. It gets worse, however. The king's slaves were mistreated, some so badly that they died. Of course, we don't do anything like that. We just ignore the king. That can't be too bad, can it? Apparently, Jesus thinks ignoring God is bad enough. To mistreat or kill God's messengers deserves a swift and harsh response, according to Jesus' parable. How do we react to some of God's messengers when they tell us things we do not want to hear? Some recent examples might include pointing out God's instructions to Israel that aliens, people who reside in your land but are not part of your people, should be treated as if they were one of your own, cared for, not deported. Or not pursuing vengeance against those who have harmed us, particularly not blaming entire nations or religions for the acts of a few extremists. Or choosing forgiveness over punishment whenever possible, in the forgive others as God forgives you mode. Or choosing peace over war, even when we feel offended against or attacked. The list could go on and on. We seem to think that because we're a democracy and get to vote for our leaders, we can ignore what God asks because it's not popular. What does happen to those who tell us inconvenient truths of any kind? Sometimes we lionize them, and then we ignore what they told us. Sometimes we ignore them completely. Frequently, we verbally attack their families, their friends, and their morals. We look for things about them we can deride. His child got in trouble. He had an extramarital affair. She dresses funny. And she doesn't behave the way a woman should. Anything to excuse us so we don't have to pay attention to the message we do not want to hear. Sometimes we even find ways to arrest or threaten the messengers, as we did with Martin Luther King before someone lost it completely and killed him. Does the fact that God uses imperfect human beings as servants and messengers make the message untrue? We better hope not, because there are very few perfect people around for God to use. One way that we deal with things we do not want to be true is to deny that they're true. I don't believe in, you fill in the blank. It could be global warming or evolution. Or the color of your skin doesn't make you essentially any different than me. Or that crossing the line drawn by a government to feed your family doesn't make you a bad person. Remember the hikers who were just released from prison in Iraq because they crossed straight across the boundary? We were appalled at the treatment they received. But it's very little different from the way we treat people that we label as illegal. Perhaps even more important in our reactions is that we are afraid that God will ask us to act as servants, to carry God's message to God's people. Our Old Testament reading from Exodus tells us about one encounter between God and one of God's servants, caused by the behavior of the people as a whole. Moses had gone up to speak to God on Mount Sinai, where he received the Ten Commandments. When Moses did not come back right away, the people asked Aaron, Moses' brother and his second in command, to make them gods to go before them. Aaron collected all the gold jewelry and cast a golden calf and proclaimed that this God had brought the people up out of the land of Egypt. Apparently, the people did not remember the plagues that had felled the Egyptians and did not touch them. They did not remember crossing the Red Sea with dry feet and watching the Egyptian army with all its horsemen and chariots drown. They must have forgotten the flocks of quail that came each evening and the manna on the ground each morning in the desert. They forgot that God gave them water from rocks in the desert. After all, that was before. This is different. This is now. Their cry is very similar to ours. What about me? What about right now? The people of Israel were very human and very impatient. God's messenger had disappeared, and they felt abandoned. They wanted a God they could count on to do what they wanted when they wanted it. In other words, they wanted an idol. Maybe what they really wanted was a God they could control. A God who would not expect too much of them or force them to grow and change. Apparently, it didn't matter to them that such a God would not be real, would not live, and could not care for or about them. When God saw what the people were doing, God was very angry and contemplated destroying the people. Moses pleaded with God to forgive the people for the sake of the promise that God had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that God would prosper their descendants and make of them a great nation. Moses makes no excuse for the people's behavior. He does not attempt to gloss over what they're doing. Instead, Moses reminds God of who God is. What saves the people is not anything they are or do. What saves them is who God is. Of course, Moses still has to go down the mountain with the Ten Commandments and try to shake these people up. Having reminded God of the need to act like the creator of the universe, Moses now has to remind the people of Israel to act like God's people, even if it means being better than they had any intention of being. Which brings us back to those guests at the wedding feast. The king is expecting them to be better than they see any reason to be. The guests invited in the first place fail the king's expectations miserably. When they actually attack the king's slaves and servants, the king destroys them and throws the door open to all. One of the things this tells us about the kingdom of heaven is it's open to everyone. It's not by invitation only. Everyone that the king's servants could round up was herded into the banquet hall. None of these people got to determine who would sit at table with them. The people were described as both good and bad. That could be expanded to all ages, both genders, of every complexion and coloring, of varying degrees of cleanliness, and from every walk of life. Imagine doing a sweep through the streets of Syracuse and herding everyone into the war memorial. That's one way of describing the kingdom of heaven. Obviously, it will not be just our kind of people, nor will anyone agree on much of anything. Certainly, there will be no doctrinal purity present. What else can we tell about the kingdom of heaven? Jesus often refers to the kingdom of heaven at hand, or at the door, or among you. He doesn't mean a kingdom that's only available after death. In the Lord's Prayer, Jesus teaches us to say, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven." This is not a request for death, but a petition for God's help, so that we, here in our earthly lives, can live the way God wants us to live. For that to happen, there need to be major changes in how we live and how we treat each other. If God's kingdom is to come on earth, it needs a vehicle to bring it to life. The vehicle that Jesus chose to create was a group of followers that became the church. As part of the church, I find this downright scary. What can I do to bring the kingdom of heaven to life here and now? I cannot pass laws or make other people do anything. I can, however, do what the early Christians did. They insisted on using honest weights and measures in the marketplace, even if their competitors did not. They treated everyone the same way. Romans and pagans were treated just like the Christians who worshipped with them. They paid their taxes in full, no matter how they felt about the Roman occupation of their country. They did their best to be kind and loving, even doing more than was required. In other words, those early Christians tried to behave as they saw Jesus behave, and as he had taught them in his preaching and in his parables. They set a very high standard for themselves. One of the reasons the church thrived and grew was that people saw Jesus' followers as the kind of people they would like to have as friends, the kind of people they would like to be themselves. We can also try to be what Jesus taught. We will not always succeed in doing it as well as we hope to, but the higher we set the standard and the harder we try, the closer we will come. What about that man with no wedding robe who got thrown out of the banquet? Does God really care so much about what we wear? I don't think this is about clothes at all. I think it's about the standards of behavior toward other people and toward God. We are to appear before God clothed in righteousness. The Bible uses righteousness to describe who God is and how God acts. When used to describe a person, it means one who acts as God would act or as God desires. None of the people mentioned as righteous in either the Old Testament or the New Testament is perfect. But they measure their behavior against God's standard, confess their failures, and seek God's forgiveness. Like the rest of us, they sometimes fool themselves for a time about their own behavior. When they're confronted with their failures, however, they try to make whatever amends they can and go back to being God's person. If the man with no wedding robe had thought to beg the king for mercy rather than remaining silent, perhaps he would not have been thrown out of the feast into the darkness. Combining this parable with many others that Jesus told about the kingdom of heaven, it sounds a lot like my grandmother's dinner table. Everyone was fed and fed well. It did not matter how you had behaved that day. You still got a tasty, balanced meal. I cannot imagine my grandmother saying, "No meat for you because you didn't clean up your room." Or, "I know carrots are your favorite, but you can't have any because you teased your little sister." Everyone needed all the parts of a good meal, and everyone got them. There were definitely rules. Wait till after grace to begin. Don't talk with your mouth full. Take turns. Pass the food when asked. Say please and thank you. You were reminded of any rules you forgot, but everyone looked out for the youngest members and the shyer guests. The conversation was lively, the food delicious, and all were included. You did not have to deserve food. What you needed, you were given. I think the kingdom of heaven is like that dinner table, overflowing with the bounty of the garden and the henhouse. filled with the aroma of whatever grandmother had been baking. There was always more than enough to eat, more than we could eat. The kingdom of heaven is not a place of scarcity. No one needs to be afraid that there will not be enough. We need only to accept God's invitation, clothe ourselves in his righteousness, and enjoy the feast with all God's other children.